As I've said many times over the last several nights, the movie The Amityville Horror, in my judgment, it's a matter of opinion, did not do a good job of outlining the horror. I've read this intro several times. I stared into the mirror in sheer disbelief. "That's not me. That can't be me," I screamed. "I, Kathleen Lutz, am a young, blonde-haired housewife with pale, soft skin. But that's not what I saw in my reflection. I had turned into a disgusting-looking 90-year-old hag. My hair was white and scraggly. Ugly creases and crow's feet scarred my face. I drooled all over my shriveled-up, dried skin. It was the work of horrible, evil spirits that had plunged my family and me into chilling terror for 28 days. That turned our dream house into a hell house. The Amityville Horror 2. The terror continues. A sharp scrape, a moan, an elongated complaint from the floorboards. The beds, he thought. Something was moving the beds of his stepsons, dragging them across the floor of their third-story room. "I've got to get up." George tried to rise, but a blast of icy wind slammed him back against the mattress. "I've got to get up," he repeated, and tried again. A smothering, invisible force like a huge fingerless hand pressed him against the bed. The box springs groaned at the sudden strain. There was a shouting upstairs. Something was clattering in the halls. A door slammed. A drawer shot free. The band yattered and screeched on the staircase. And now he couldn't scream. He couldn't breathe. Something was stealing the air out of his lungs. "No, I've got to get up. I've got to get to the boys. I've got to..." "No, no." The fence or the force closed over him. George blacked out. That's the intro to number 2. And then there's a third one. Amityville, the final chapter. Millions know of the horror that haunted the Lutz family and their famous house in Amityville, Long Island. Millions shared their terror when they fled and shared their hope when they tried to fight the evil with exorcism, told in Amityville 2. But their hopes were cruelly shattered when the horror returned to stalk them and their children to the ends of the earth. For the force was even more evil and more determined than before. Now read the shocking conclusion to the nightmare that has terrified more people than any other true story ever told. Now I know that you're getting bored with all these demonology subjects. That's why I gave us some R&R with Jeremiah. And I'll go back to Jeremiah. You want me to read you a ghost story?
Yes, sir.
They had the medium, Francine, visit the house over and against the opposition of Father Mancuso. The medium, Francine, was having all kinds of strange sensations, turn the lights down, in the house. Remember that? She'd stop in various places, say people were buried here. Then she left. No, she hadn't left yet. That's where we were. They went up to the sewing room. Francine walked inside. Now, the sewing room was where they had the strange invasion of flies, remember? I mean, everybody should be listening every night. I shouldn't have to review. Amityville Horror. True story. Suddenly, Francine, the medium, appeared to go into a trance. Out of her mouth came a different voice, heavier, more masculine. When Francine came out of the trance, she and her husband quickly left. Back in the living room, George and Kathy were silent for a long time. Francine had said she'd come back when the vibrations were better. Finally, Kathy asked, "What do you think?" "I don't know," George answered. "I just don't know." She was hitting things right on the head. He stood up to put out the fire. "I'll have to think about it for a while." He had been wondering, because that masculine voice that came from Francine had a ring of familiarity to it. Kathy went upstairs to check on the children. George made his usual check of all the doors and locks, then turned out the lights on the first floor. He went up the steps to his bedroom, then stopped before he reached the second floor landing. George saw that the banister above him was wrenched from its moorings, torn almost completely off the floor foundation. At that very instant, he recalled whose voice had been speaking to him through Francine. It was Father Mancuso. Remember earlier they'd gone to a wedding with Jimmy and his new bride, Carrie. He had had $1,500 taken from him, the bride, groom. Now, they've come back from the wedding, January 8th. George worked all morning to fit the second floor banister's broken anchor post back in their sockets. When the boys came down for breakfast, both wanted to help. But George shooed him out of the way, telling him to go shopping for new shoes with her mother. No one, Danny, Chris, Missy, or Kathy, had heard the banister being wrenched off its post during the night. What had caused this latest damage in the house remained a mystery. George and Kathy had their ideas, but didn't voice it in front of the kids. They discussed the medium and what the Venetian veil is. Father Mancuso, in the meantime, nursed his most recent and recurrent case of sickness. He had resigned himself to this newest affliction as another show of power and displeasure by the evil force he had alienated at 112 Ocean Avenue. This time, there had been no solicitous call by the pastor, even though Father Mancuso was sure the cleric had been informed of his new illness. He remained in his own apartment, resting in bed. His fever ranged as high as 104 degrees. His stomach hurt continuously, and as the day wore on, he alternated between chills and sweating. Father Mancuso hadn't even attempted to reach the chancellor's office again. He felt the aches and pains would eventually lessen if he divorced himself from thinking about the Lutz situation. The devil really had him on the run. By 4 o'clock, Kathy returned from her shopping. Various conversations I'll skip. Everyone retired fairly early. Before turning in, George and Jimmy checked the house inside and out. George showed Jimmy the damaged garage door, but didn't offer any explanation beyond the theory that it was caused by a freak windstorm. Now, Jimmy's the one that got married and had been gone. Now he's back. Jimmy, who had been victimized of his money by an unknown source, was suspicious of something else. But he, too, kept silent and followed George as he checked the boathouse. Back inside, they continued their tour of doors and windows until both were satisfied with the security of 112 Ocean Avenue. It was 11 o'clock when the couple said goodnight to one another. George knows that it happened at 3:15 a.m. George knows that it happened at 3:15 a.m. because he had been lying awake a few minutes and had checked his wristwatch. It was then that Carrie woke up screaming. Oh God, not her too, he muttered to himself. George leaped out of bed, ran to Missy's room, and snapped on the light. The young couple were huddled together in bed. Jimmy was cradling his sobbing wife. What's the matter, George asked. What happened? Carrie, she's the new bride. Honeymoon just ended. Carrie pointed to the foot of Missy's bed. Something was sitting there. It touched my foot. George approached the spot Carrie had indicated and felt the bed with his hand. It was warm, as though someone had been sitting there. I'm reading the Amityville Horror, a true story by Jay Anson. Bantam Books. I'm going to give it away to everybody at the banquet Sunday, so I don't really have to finish the story, do I? It was warm, as though someone had been sitting there. I woke up, Carrie continued, and I could see a little boy. He looked so sick. He was trying to tell me to help him. She began to cry hysterically. Jimmy soothed his wife gently. He says, come on, Carrie. You were probably having a dream. And no, Jimmy, Carrie protested. It wasn't a dream. I saw him. He spoke to me. What did he say, Carrie? George asked. Carrie's shoulders were still shaken, but gradually she looked up from her husband's arms. George heard a noise behind him and a touch on his shoulder. He jumped, then looked around. It was Kathy this time. Her eyes were misty, as though she too had been crying. Kathy! Carrie cried. What did the little boy say? Kathy prompted her. He asked me where Missy and Jody were. At the mention of Missy's name, Kathy bolted from the bedroom and ran to the other side of the hallway. In the dressing room, the little girl was fast asleep with one foot sticking out in the air. Kathy lifted Missy's blanket, bent her leg back under the covers, then leaned down, kissed her child on the head. George came into the room. Is Missy all right? Kathy nodded. In about 15 minutes, Carrie had quieted down enough to fall asleep. Jimmy was still nervous, but soon he drifted off too. George and Kathy had shut the door on the couple and returned to their own bedroom. Immediately, she went into the closet, took out the crucifix that hung inside. George, she said, let's bless the house ourselves. They haven't been able to get a priest out there. They began on the third floor in the children's playroom. In the eerie pre-dawn silence of the cold room, George held the crucifix in front of him while Kathy intoned the Lord's Prayer. They did not go into Danny and Chris's room. Kathy said they could wait until the next day to bless that room and the ones in which Missy and Jimmy and Carrie were sleeping. They moved on to their own bedroom and then to the sewing room on the second floor. Warning his wife to be careful of the newly repaired banister, George led the way down to the first floor, still brandishing a silver crucifix as he supposed a priest would during a holy procession. When they completed their blessing of the kitchen and the dining room, it was just starting to get light outside. Even without turning on the lights, they could see the living room dimly visible before them. George marched around the furniture, and Kathy started to recite. Our Father who art in heaven, hallowed be thy... She was interrupted by... Our Father who art in heaven, hallowed be thy... She was interrupted... Bye. Not interested in this. Kathy, lying in bed, could hear her mother downstairs. I've gone over to page 225. I've never really enjoyed reading one with the sense of knowledge before that you'll be able to not be frustrated because I'm giving this away at the banquet. So I can skip around anywhere. It doesn't really matter. You say, well, I'm not coming. Look, there's a plane that'll fly from wherever you are tomorrow. Everybody listening to me can get to my banquet. Kathy, page 225. I skipped that other thing so you'll know how to finish it. It was on page 208. 208. Let's just leave it on 208 for the moment. Kathy, lying in bed, could hear her mother downstairs shouting into the telephone at her brother. She sighed and opened her robe once more to look at the burning red marks on her body. Oh, that was something that happened between 208 and 225. The welts were still there, but they did seem fainter. Then she tried touching one of the slashes under her right breast. That also happened. It was between 208 and 225. Her finger rested on the ugly spot. It seemed to Kathy that the sensation wasn't as severe as before. The reaction was more like putting her finger under very warm water. Again, she sighed. Kathy was about to close her bathrobe when she sensed someone was staring at her nakedness. The feeling of a presence came from right behind her. The feeling of a presence came from right behind her, but Kathy couldn't bring herself to turn and look. She knew the mirrored wall was there, and she was afraid that in it she would see something terrible. Paralyzed with fear, she was unable to even raise her arms to draw the robe about her. That's page 226. George couldn't understand why Kathy kept saying he was yelling, "I'm coming apart." This is where we were. He knew perfectly. I've been looking for this. Page 245. He knew perfectly well what he had said was, "I'm coming unglued." Now he remembered he had been sitting in the chair when suddenly he felt a powerful grip lift up the chair with him in it and slowly turn him around. We got an opening coming up with some new stations. I think I can go a bit further. I'm boring you. Now he remembered he had been sitting in the chair when suddenly he felt a powerful grip lift up the chair with him in it and slowly turn him around. Powerless to move, George saw the hooded figure he had first seen in the living room fireplace, its blasted half face glaring at him. The horribly disfigured features became clear to George. "God help me," he screamed. George couldn't understand. Why did Kathy say he was yelling, "I'm coming apart"? He knew perfectly well what he had said was, "I'm coming unglued." Isn't that right? Now he remembered he had been sitting in the chair when suddenly he felt a powerful grip lift up the chair with him in it and slowly turn him around. Powerless to move, George saw the hooded figure he had first seen in the living room fireplace, its blasted half face glaring at him, the horribly disfigured features became clearer to George. He recognized him. "God help me!" he screamed. Then he saw his own face emerge from beneath the white hood. It was torn in two. "I'm coming unglued," George yelled. "I would unglue you, wouldn't it?" But what he meant was his own head was coming unglued under that hood. Am I boring you? Frustrating you? Well, you're still alive. Now, still groggy, He began to argue with Kathy. "I know what I said," he muttered. "Don't tell me what I said." The others backed off. "He's still asleep," Kathy thought, "and he's having a bad dream." "You're right, George," she said gently. "You didn't say that at all." She pulled his head to her breast. "Daddy," Missy broke in, "come to my room. Jody says he wants to talk to you." The urgency of his daughter's voice broke the spell. George snapped out of it and jumped up, almost bowling Kathy over. "Jody, who's Jody?" "That's her friend," answered Kathy. "You know, I told you she makes up imaginary people. You can't see Jody." "Oh, yes, Mama," Missy protested. "I see him all the time. He's the biggest pig you ever saw." Then she trotted out of the room and was gone. George and Kathy looked at each other. "A pig?" He said, it struck them both at the same time. They remembered the cloven hoofs and the snow, the prints. "The pig's in her room." George ran after Missy. "You stay here," he yelled at Kathy and the boys. Missy was just climbing on the bed when George stopped outside her bedroom door. He didn't see Jody or anything like a pig. "Where's this Jody?" he asked Missy. "Oh, he'll be right back," the little girl said, setting the covers around herself. "He had to go outside for a minute." George let out his breath. After the weird dream of the hooded figure, George had expected the worst when he heard the word pig. His neck felt stiff, and he rotated it, trying to work out the tight feeling. "It's all right," he yelled back to Kathy. "Jody's not here." "There he is, Daddy." George looked down at Missy. She was pointing to one of her windows. His eyes followed her finger, and he started. Staring at him through one of the panes were two fiery red eyes. No face. Just the mean little eyes of a pig. "That's Jody," cried Missy. "He wants to come in." Something rushed past George on his left. It was some of these cities. I sure don't know if they want me to continue. I'm back to where we were last night. I made it all the way back. I don't don't really have to finish because I'm going to give this away at my banquet. I could go to the next two books, Amityville Horror 2 and Amityville, the final chapter. You know, I don't really have to move along very fast. I can just skip. Because you're going to get this book at my banquet. You got that? Sunday. I'm going to get this book. You're going to get this, plus you're going to get to know what the secret is. If you've been confirmed. If you haven't been confirmed, you better call and say, I haven't been confirmed, because my staff's confirming you tonight. I don't even know if we're in these cities. Got games going all the time. Don't even know when we come on sometimes. I think we better let you. You want me to finish this? Now, it's time for me to say, I'm not just reading these stories to be sensational or because they're interesting, though they are sensational and they are interesting. This is part of a whole series of teachings I've been doing, seeking a gestalt, a feel, a realization. It's hard to get the attention of modern man. For a couple of centuries, we've been buried in naturalism and rationalism and denial of the supernatural. Yet the Old Testament and the New Testament are full of records about the existence of an evil, not just a force, a personalized evil being in cadres of lieutenants called demons that war against God and war against man and seek to break the tie of faith with God and to destroy man. Now, if the Bible has any credibility in a modern world, there's got to be some evidence in a modern world of these supernatural, personalized, evil beings. Now, we started out questioning and probing some of the mysteries around the Bermuda Triangle. One that you may have forgotten was the case of the crypt with the movable caskets in it, recorded. We went from there to the demonologist, the story of the Catholic lay people, Ed and Lorraine Warren, and their experiences with the supernatural. The credibility of Ed and Lorraine Warren is a bit above the average on this subject. They were called in by none other than the commandant, superintendent of West Point, to deal with a ghostly happening. They were experts called in on the Amityville case. We went to the Philippines and read of the girl bitten by demons. We began to just touch the surface of shamanism. I'm merely trying to get one simple thought across before I dive rather heavily into the biblical theology of demons. Theology is a wrong word. It's become a generic word to speak of all things biblical, but theology speaks of God. Angelology of the supporting personalities in his kingdom, demonology, and doctrines of these supernatural beings throughout the Bible that represent the alien force that rebelled against God under Lucifer. I'm going to dive into the biblical frame of demonology and the role of the devil, but I'm trying to set a frame right now, which is a gestalt. But there is evidence. So those who take the trouble to look, and I don't, you know, I find these stories more unbelievable than most people. I'm a skeptic going out the gate. In fact, I even ask people to apply as Ghostbusters to go to New England and look in on the evidence of some of these things. There was a movie done of the Amityville Horror, but I don't think a very good one. That's my opinion. The book is terrorizing. Now there are two more, Amityville Horror 2 and Amityville, the final chapter. We also looked at the book The Devil in Connecticut, where a boy, Arnie Johnson's in prison there tonight, claiming that demon possession caused him to do what he did. There's abundant evidence around. Sure, I'm tantalizing you. I got a job to do, and that's to get ready for the banquet Sunday. And some of you cities that are a bit frustrated at the time I'm taking should remember that it's Los Angeles that paid the bill to bring us in, so whatever teaching you've received, the cities, with exception of one or two, aren't in the black yet, and I'll be right back. No, you're leaving somebody. I thought he was just joining somebody. I really will be right back. Some cities will be giving commercials, but some of you I can talk to. I want the cities that we're in to remember. Los Angeles pays the bill. And Sunday is a very important day for us. And some are going to miss because you've not been confirmed or you've procrastinated and waited so long. There's still time. My staff will be calling tonight and all day tomorrow and tomorrow night and Saturday. If you've not been confirmed, you should get on the phone and call me. That's why we're taking this time. But I also want you to know, as I read these stories, I'm not just playing games. There are people who grow up and go through life and never ever stop and think about these things. That makes the devil happy. You get involved in the life of faith, you'll find out the devil's real. And a lot of you that have made decisions of faith, which is the way of salvation, need to understand the forces we're up against. Don't let it terrorize you. Greater is he that is in us than he that's in the world. But you need to understand your enemy and how to do battle against him. The Lutzes obviously didn't. There's a passage that I skipped over where he goes into a rage one night that all of their life savings were invested in this house. And he's not about to leave it. Well, we'll see. As the days march on in this story, the Bible makes it very clear that unseen, powerful forces of evil personified Lucifer and his agents, the devil and his hierarchy of lieutenants, fallen angels, and demons are there to oppress. Paul said, we wrestle not against flesh and blood, but against principalities and power. I'm, from many sources, showing you there's a lot of evidence that such forces do exist. We've moved across the gamut from the Judaic Encyclopedia to the poltergeist in John Wesley's house, his parents' house. Now I'm reading The Amityville Horror, a true story by Jay Anson. A movie was made of it. There's more to the story than the movie gave you. George has just run into Missy's room. I'm on page 247, so you can remember, because I'm going to give this book away at the banquet. Answer the phones now at King's House 1. Don't take any more calls in here. Finish the ones you have. Go ahead and finish. Just try to keep your voice down. Lower the lights. I want to read. George has just run into his little girl's room, Missy's room. She keeps seeing a pig called Jody, a manifestation of the demon force that's been terrorizing. George runs in the room, doesn't see anything. It's all right, he yelled back to Kathy, his wife, Jody's not here. Now, they've found cloven hoof prints in the snow. The little girl is always talking about this Jody. He yelled back at Kathy, his wife, Jody's not here. There he is, Daddy. George looked down at Missy. She was pointing to one of her windows. His eyes followed her finger, and he started. Staring at him through one of the panes were two fiery red eyes. No face. Just the mean little eyes of a pig. That's Jody, cried Missy. He wants to come in. Something rushed past George on his left. It was. That's where we were. Something rushed past George on his left. It was. That's exactly where we were. Are we in agreement on that fact? Something rushed past George on his left, not on his right. On his left. Sinister. It was something rushed past George on his left. Wasn't what he thought it was. It was Kathy. Thank God it was Kathy. Screaming in an unearthly voice. In the same move that it took her to reach the window, she picked up one of Missy's little play chairs and swung it at the pair of eyes. Good! Now we're getting somewhere. Her blow shattered the window and shards of glass flew back on top of her. There was an animal cry of pain, a loud squealing. And the eyes were gone. George rushed to what was left of the second story window and looked out. He saw nothing below, but he still heard the squealing. I don't believe this, but I'm starting to. It sounded as if it was headed for the boathouse. Then Kathy's crying whimper caught George's attention. He turned to his wife. Kathy's face was terrifying. Her eyes were wild, her mouth was tightly screwed up. She was trying to choke out words. Finally, she blurted, "It's been here all the time. I wanted to kill it. I wanted to kill it." And then her whole body slumped. George caught his wife and silently picked her up. In the meantime, Father Mancuso, still battling the attacks of Satan himself, trying to get permission of his bishop to do something about it, calls on his bishop again. Is ordered to stay away from it. Later in the day, Kathy was giving Missy her lunch. Kathy was watching Missy eat. The little girl seemed to be having a secret conversation with someone under the kitchen table. Every once in a while, Missy would extend her hand beneath the plastic tablecloth to offer her peanut butter and jelly sandwich. She didn't seem to be aware her mother was watching her movements. From her position, Kathy could see there wasn't anything under the table. But she didn't want to ask her daughter about Jody. But finally, she said, "Missy, is Jody the angel you told me about?" The little girl looked at her mother, confusion on her face. "You remember," Kathy continued, "you asked me if angels speak." Missy's eyes lit up. "Yes, Mama." She nodded. "Jody's an angel. He talks to me all the time." "I understand," her mother said. "You've seen pictures of angels." Missy nodded again. "You said he's a pig, so how can you say he's an angel?" Missy's eyebrows grew together as she concentrated. "He says he is, Mama. He told me." "What does he say when he talks to you?" Again, the little girl seemed confused. "You know what I mean, Missy. Do you play games?" "Oh, no. He tells me about the little boy who used to live in my room. He died, Mama. The little boy got sick and he died." "I see. What else did he tell you?" Last night he said I was going to live here forever so I could play with the little boy. Horrified, Kathy put her finger to her mouth because she wanted to scream. George's session with the IRS hadn't gone very well. Birds of a feather flocked together. On top of everything else, the IRS is auditing George. When he arrived home, Kathy and Missy had their coats on. "Don't undress, George," she said. "We're leaving for my mother's right now." "I'm going to move." George and the two boys looked at her. "What happened?" he asked. "Jody told Missy he's an angel. That's what happened, and we're getting out of here." George held up his hands. "Wait a minute, will you? What do you mean he's an angel?" "Missy," Kathy said, "tell your father what the pig said." "Well, he's an angel, Daddy. He told me." George was about to ask his daughter another question when he was interrupted by loud barking behind the house. "Harry," he cried. "We forgot about Harry." When George and the others reached him, Harry was barking furiously at the boathouse, frantically running around his compound, jerking up short every time he reached the end of his steel leash. "What's the matter, boy?" George said, patting the dog's neck. "Someone in the boathouse?" Harry twisted out of his grasp. "Don't go in there," Kathy yelled. "Please, let's get out of here now." George hesitated, then bent down, snapped the leash off of Harry's collar. The dog leaped forward with a savage snarl and ran out of his gate. The door to the boathouse was closed, and the best Harry could do was leap against it. Again, he started his wild barking. George was all set to unlock the door and fling it open. That's on page 253. Let's move on. You can finish that if you come to the banquet. In the meantime, Father Mancuso, still so worked up, the bishop won't let him do anything. Father Mancuso, it says, was an individual who despised bullies, be they man, animal, or the unknown. The priest felt that the force that had 112 Ocean Avenue in his grip was taking undue advantage of the fears of the Lutzes and of himself. The priest knew there was only one answer. It had to be demonic. Well, he's getting somewhere. Just to be on the safe side, George and Kathy decided the children should sleep in the master bedroom. With Harry inside, down in the cellar, we skipped over, you know, what happened out there. Danny, Chris, and Missy were put to bed. George and Kathy made themselves as comfortable as they could. Kathy stretched out on two chairs. George insisted he was all right with one. He told Kathy he planned to stay awake all night and sleep in the morning. At 3:15 a.m., George heard the marching band strike up downstairs. I don't believe any of this.
This is the end of side one. For the rest of the teaching, please turn the tape over for side two. Thank you.